Welcome to another episode of Threads of Enlightenment. As usual, I cannot wait to talk to this gentleman. We welcome them, first of all, and it is with honor and respect that we are glad that they are here, because they are now going to entrust us with their journey, their wisdom, their insights, so that you and I can become a better human spirit while we occupy this place called Earth. Because we know that someday in our lives we will change form. But while we are here, we want to experience as much of living as we can. Jeremy, I want to welcome you to Threads of Enlightenment. Thank you so much, sir. Talk to the people. Tell them all that good stuff that you've done in life so far.
It's nice to be here. tell you all the stuff I've got in the background here. Some of my lineage, if we were talking earlier about, you and I were talking earlier about the, how we got here, where you stand depends on where you sit, yeah. Is one way that's sometimes described. That is, you know, you've got a lineage, your biological lineage, your family lineage, your cultural lineage, mm-hmm. All of that stuff. And how you describe that as how we end up programmed, and yeah. how we can do a kind of thing. You call it enlightenment. I call it anthro introspection.
Yes,
that is to think. In my case, it's about putting myself in context, mm-hmm. Recognizing that I'm this mid-sized mammal. I'm one of these mid-sized mammals that recently acquired this newfangled contraption called language, mm-hmm. Which enables me to do all this detailed conceptualizing about who I am, about where I fit in, about who others are. All of that stuff has been my life's work, the shank of my life's work. I've been doing it for about 30 years through the sciences.
Yeah.
That is, I do the pursuit of self-knowledge through an understanding of my broadest context. Mm-hmm. I describe my work as cradle to grave. Mm-hmm. That is, for 25 years now, I've been working on the chemical origins of life,
yeah.
of souls, you could say. How beings and trying mm-hmm. ever emerge from chemistry, which is not trying.
Yeah.
It doesn't, chemistry's not trying, organisms are trying. So that's the cradle side of my research. It's from the origins of life. And the grave is to our grave situation, the complexities that we're now dealing with in the world. So I span this whole research area, but I didn't start out here. I started out as an anxious, I would say inarticulate member of a kind of family that still exists. These were Russian Jews mm-hmm. who immigrated to the United States around the 1900s. Mm-hmm. And then ended up doing well. Yeah. So I came from a wealthy family. My father had started Midas Mufflers. My father and grandfather started Midas Mufflers.
Wow.
And I inherited I inherited substantial money at age 16.
Mm-hmm.
And being an anxious kid and not the achiever of the family, I have three brothers, and the other two were they were growing up faster than I was.
Yeah.
I was pretty lost and confused for a long time, and then had a wonderful journey through all sorts of rides in life's amusement park before landing on the work that I now do full time.
That's
headlines or summary. I don't know. I mean, I could go into details about all that, but it's been a fun journey, and I end up with a very weird life
yeah.
compared to a lot of other people's lives.
Well, let's talk about some of that, roller coasters rides that you've been on. So here you were, you described this young man. Talk to me as to how this young man began to process and looked at himself as in that household with those overachievers. Brothers and family.
I may have been an under. They may have been achievers. I might have been an underachiever. I don't know if they were overachievers. But all I know was that I didn't feel like I was achieving much. And by about eight, mm-hmm. This is a culture. Jewish people in Chicago, being the kind of troubled child or problem child of the family,
yeah.
And milking it.
Yeah.
There was a way in which I relied on that role in order to get attention.
Yeah.
I asked to go into psychoanalysis. At age 8, I had 5 years of 4 days a week psychoanalysis.
You asked for that. Couch,
I asked for it.
Gotcha. But,
and to this day, I can't tell how much of that was me really being troubled or how much of me that was me vying for some kind of attention in the family with these achievers. Mm-hmm. And it being an open niche, that is, I could play the role of the problem child. I can't tell how much I can't tell how much I was troubled and how much I was milking being troubled.
Yeah.
But one way or another, it felt real to me, and I had those years. So that's an interesting thing to do at 8 years old.
Yeah.
You're in the psychoanalyst's office. He's not talking to you hardly at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, I can't remember words he said to me. I'm lying on the couch. And the time has been dedicated for me to look at myself.
Yeah.
And that's not a comfortable thing to do necessarily,
yeah.
At least not at first. But it did end up, I had those 5 years of Freudian analysis, mm-hmm. and then I had another 5 starting at age about 35. So between the two, I ended up kind of shameless.
Mm.
That is one of the thing I would claim I got out of the psychoanalysis was I'm not as twitchy.
Yeah.
Discovering in me the traits that humans can end up with,
yeah.
The anxieties, the doubts, mm-hmm. the self-doubts, the shadow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so at first I couldn't look at it, and then I would look at it. I mean, you say over time I got to where I could laugh nervously at my own foibles, and then I started to laugh calmly at my own foibles to recognize that human... There's a real big transition, and I've skipped over some of the amusement park rides, but yeah. I wanted to say that what ended up happening to me out of that therapy was mostly about what was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what therapy will tend to be. And then I switched at about, I would say, around late 30s, mm-hmm. I suddenly turned the question to what's up with us.
Yeah.
Not what's wrong with me so much, but what's up with us. Me included in mm-hmm, us.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up with this kind of line of work that I call anthro-introspection. I don't make a big deal out of that term, but it captures what I'm after describing. And actually, if I want, it's a little bit more of a mouthful, but I would call it anthro-introspeculation.
Yeah.
That is, I will not know myself mm-hmm. in any kind of absolute way. I'm not looking for a static self. I'm looking at this being that is constantly going through whipsawed around by things, changes. I'm a work in progress.
Yeah.
Obviously, so it's not like to know myself in some absolute way. And I find it a red flag when someone speaks in matter of fact terms about what they are. If someone says, "I'm a truth seeker," or any of the things where, you know, you kind of self-reported self-flattery,
yeah.
never works for me. I'm not allowed to say that stuff about me. I can't tell you that I'm a good person in any, I can't say I have integrity. That's not how I think those things work.
Yeah.
But to speculate about what's going on with me, what's going on with us, that ended up being my life's work and ended up providing a kind of peace of mind that I didn't have as a child. When I was much more interested in reaching a static state of enlightenment, some static state where I could no longer worry about the possibility of being a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the transition for me was I had a couple of mantras early on in this work that ended up mattering to me. One was, I wouldn't put it past me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past me to do the things that people do. Why would I be an exception?
Yeah.
And another one was, no matter how hard I chase the truth, it will never catch me. which is a recognition that, you know, it's a kind of a game of hide and seek to get to know yourself. You know, you go spelunking around the cave of your mind, mm-hmm. and you do it gingerly because you don't want to find out that you turned out to be one of those guys, whatever it is. So anyway. Yeah, that's all background, but the transition to getting to there, to where I really started this life's work, the last 30 years of research, that transition included me joining the world's largest hippie commune in Tennessee and signing a vow of poverty and living there for 7 years, doing work in Guatemala, doing water projects in Guatemala, founding a nonprofit lobbying organization on environmental and nuclear issues with a bunch of chapters in the U.S., mm-hmm. Working with green companies, taking a master's in public policy, and then later a PhD. When I got really interested in what's up with us,
yeah.
I finally took a PhD in what's called evolutionary epistemology, but really basically what it is, just trying to understand how organisms have shopped among interpretations mm-hmm. of their reality, how that happens, how that even starts from chemistry. That was what my PhD was in. It's basically a cross between evolutionary theory and decision theory, understanding how decisions get made.
Now, Jeremy, I want you to stop here for a minute. What happened or a series of happening that took place in your life to made you say, this is the specific route that I wanted to go after you've been exposed to all of these different things? What was that core, as I mentioned, it's a series usually, It crystallized with a particular conversation or something that will crystallize what was that?
That's a great question. Doesn't get asked often enough. Just the practicalities of how you make a transition like this. Mm-hmm. I was very status conscious mm-hmm. because of the money.
Yeah.
That is, this wasn't true across my family. It was to some extent it was true for my dad, who became went from being a corporate guy to being an activist, mm-hmm. Working with Ralph Nader, Jesse Jackson, Saul Alinsky, all these activists, leftist activists or progressive activists. But most of my family was okay with having the money. I was not. Yeah. From an early age, I felt like I had to prove my worth. If you can imagine someone saying to you, here's a salary for the rest of your life, earn it if you want. Mm-hmm. You know, at the age of 16 or so, you get the sense that, wow, you know, it's a kind of vocational derailment, but not in my case. In my case, I felt like if I could never justify having gotten that money unless I did something as important as Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And that wasn't likely to happen, but it was still a sense of obligation to prove myself that manifested mostly as a kind of balking if someone asked me what I did.
Yeah.
If someone asked me, you know, like a cocktail party or someone, so what do you do? That question would generally lock me up.
Wow.
And I was looking for, you know, it would kind of paralyze me because I wanted to be able to say that I was doing something important. And you know the sound of someone. You go to a cocktail party or ask someone how they're doing, and you can definitely hear them saying what they need to hear in order to soothe themselves, in order to give themselves confidence that they're on the right, mm-hmm. that they're on, they're part of the solution, not part of the problem, mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, or that they're a big name, whatever, what we Jews would call big machers, big makers. So I struggled with that and never came up with anything. Mm. Never came up with anything and could not decide what to do. Tried various things, like I say. I mean, I didn't list all the things I did, but those were some of them. They were the main threads of what I did, the ones I described. Sometimes you don't answer a question, you get over a question.
Yeah.
And in my case, that's sort of what happened. I got really interested for the first time. I'd had a fair amount of education. But it was all like drinking from a fire hose, and I still didn't know what to do with it or any of that. And suddenly, instead of me setting myself to just be forced to take education, I got eaten up by curiosity.
Yeah.
Suddenly, I got really curious about what's up with us.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of pivot points, I would say, that preceded me really getting the thread that I wanted to follow out.
Yeah.
And it was only kind of later that I realized, oh, this is the path I ended up with. But there are a couple of pivot points. One was a friend of mine who was quite successful. He was an inheritor, but he was also very successful.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he said to me, I was probably in my early 30s. He said to me, you know what I wish for you, Jeremy? I wish that you screwed up really royally one time. And then you'd notice that not everybody is watching you. Not everybody's monitoring you to the obsessive level that you think they are.
Yeah.
you'd relax. They're all busy. They're all busy being anxious about how they're perceived. Mm-hmm. They're not busy looking at you. And shortly after that, I did enter something of a midlife crisis. There were a number of things that hit me all at once, including the sense that my that national lobbying organization I founded wasn't actually making as much of a social change as I hoped it was. Yeah. My one marriage was breaking up. And I have a firstborn who turned out to have really interesting mental challenges, mm-hmm. That didn't engender sympathy. He was kind of psychopathic. Mm-hmm. So dealing with that challenge, which I don't talk about much, but it did get me interested in decision theory. I was trying to figure out, is my son being indulgent or is he handicapped? Mm-hmm. And I started to realize, wait a second, if he's handicapped, I've got to accommodate him. If he's indulgent, I'm his father, I have to push him.
Yeah.
And I started to get really interested in tough judgment calls. Mm-hmm. But there was another moment for me along the way, and it's actually how I stopped doing the psychotherapy, mm-hmm. stopped taking the psychotherapy. I'm sitting there at a at an event with Dan Ellsberg. Mm-hmm. With Ram Dass.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Do you know that guy named Ram Dass? Yes. And he was basically half comedian, and he had a shtick. Mm-hmm. That is, he had his routine, and I had heard this a couple of times, but he had said, I had 10 years of psychoanalysis. I taught psychology at Harvard. I have taken every psychotherapeutic drug there is, all the psychedelics, mm-hmm. all of that. And I've studied with India's greatest masters, and I haven't lost one of my neuroses, he says. I haven't lost one of my neuroses. They've just gone from being these formidable, terrifying forces that would enter into my life to being these, he used the term snoids.
Yeah.
Snoid was a character created by the underground cartoonist R. Crumb, mm-hmm. to represent your inner anxieties. Yeah. He says, they've gone from being these formidable forces to becoming these snoids. They come by, I invite them in for tea.
Yeah.
And there was a real way I realized around that time that psychotherapy was great for getting you to really focus, to corner yourself with your shadow, but not great for you getting beyond your shadow, for you to move on, because therapy is its own industry, and mm-hmm. you know, they want to keep you focused there. Not all of them, but there was a way in which I felt, you know, my therapist, neither of the two therapists from at 8 years old or at 30, in mid-30s, ever said I was done.
Yeah.
But I realized out of that, okay, I'm done. The next move is to get over my shadow side.
Yes.
And the way I ended up doing that was getting interested in humans, in humans and our evolution.
Yeah.
Basically, what you described in beliefs, mm-hmm. I've got a bioanthropological approach to how that happens.
Yes.
I wouldn't use the word programming exactly. It's like programming, but it's a little different. Mm-hmm. And I also would say that from my perspective, and I wouldn't just say that my beliefs form my habits. I think it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. I often will, people will often have habits and then end up with beliefs that are harmonious with their habits.
Yes.
I think one of people's favorite prayers is, God grant me one good reason for what I just did. <You know? laughs> And I don't mean God, I'm an atheist, but I do mean the human mind is fabulous, mm-hmm. at coming up with explanations for what we did,
or for
what we want to do.
Yeah.
This is one of the problems with us, mm-hmm. is that words come so easily to us, and they make self-rationalization really easy. So it's a two-way street. My beliefs shape my habits, and my habits shape my beliefs.
Yes. How old were you, Jeremy? Where you picked that up? I don't know if it's shame, but where did you pick, how old were you when you picked that up, that belief about because you have the money that you had to show your worth? How old were you when you think
good question.
That entered in?
So often beliefs will merge. Mm-hmm. That is, you'll have two beliefs that are hard to distinguish, even though they started out as distinct. So I would say it was two things that came together. One was that, and I don't deserve any pity, and I'm not asking for it, I don't think. But I was kind of the runt of the family. That is, I was not very articulate. My older two brothers were. My dad was also very articulate, and I was not particularly. So there was a way in which I felt kind of cowed at home. Mm-hmm. I had a chip on my shoulder one way or another. Mm-hmm. And then in the meantime, I'm living through the 60s in a progressive family. In an urban setting, mm-hmm. and I'm also, you know, my dad has Ralph Nader over for dinner. My dad has Saul Alinsky over for dinner. So there was a sense of the social injustices as a major issue. And then my dad got deep into it, mm-hmm. and I was trying to be like my dad. Mm-hmm. I had a kind of I wanted to be like him, or I wanted to be in contrast to him. I was orbiting him, either very attracted to what he was or very repulsed by what he was. I wanted to be different. I wanted to either differentiate myself from him or be just like him. And I oscillated between those two. But I wouldn't be surprised if part of the thread was also wanting to be like my dad, who was becoming this progressive activist. Mm-hmm. There was something about the era. We felt like things were going to be transitioning fast. We were idealistic and naive.
Yeah.
We didn't recognize, like most idealists, that whenever there's a fast-moving movement, there's usually a backlash. Yeah. It's not like the powers of unenlightenment suddenly surrender and say, you know, you were right. Mm-hmm. No. And these days we're experiencing a formidable backlash against the progressive era's kinds of moves towards openness, respect, and all of that. But at the time, it was a heady time when we were feeling like, yeah, no, this is the age of Aquarius. It's all about this come together. The music will bring us together, that kind of thing. So I'm sure that was also part of the flavor of it.
Yeah.
And yet, like I say, I had brothers who were totally into the counterculture like I was, but they didn't have that same feeling.
Wow.
They ended up finding careers that made good use of their freedom, but they didn't feel the need to be doing work on social justice quite the way I did at the time. And I think that was, like I say, it's a dovetailing of my own guilt and feeling of inadequacy, the money and the culture. I would say that those three probably came together and made me willing at age 20 to just give away my entire inheritance, everything I had inherited up until then, sign a vow of poverty, and join this collective that was out to save the world. It was 1,400 hippies who were out to save the world, living in rural Tennessee. I spent 2.5 years with them doing water projects in poor Guatemalan villages as part of our hippie Peace Corps. I mean, yeah, and that was thrilling to me. It was freedom from guilt. I knew that I was on the side of good.
Yeah.
That's how I thought of it at the time.
Oh, awesome. I love that. Now, I know I don't want you to basically talk. I know you said you don't talk about your son, but I want to talk about you in that situation, in that place. How did it move you as an individual? How did it challenge you as an individual? To live with that knowledge, number one, but as a human, as you say, how did it mold and cause you to think and that type of thing? How did it shape you?
Well, it's a great question. So he was born on the commune. That is, I married on the commune, and then we had the child there, and we left when we were about 2 years old. He was about 2 years old. On the commune and throughout my childhood, throughout this kind of naive, idealistic childhood, I assumed that everybody was an educatable unit, that all we had to do was go out and teach the world, you know, just tell people, you could say reprogram people to be kind, to be nice, to be generous, to be enlightened, to pursue enlightenment or be enlightened, that it was a simple thing. It was almost like factory work.
Yeah.
That is, wake people up. So the whole concept of wokeness, which I have very mixed feelings about. I'm in the business of waking people up, and yet I find that woke almost, I would say woke doesn't work. I would also want to make clear that from my perspective, there is no more dangerous woke movement in the United States these days than Trumpism. Yeah. It is a woke movement. Yeah. That is, it's I once was lost, but now I'm found.
Yeah.
And now I get to lord it over everybody else because I have found the light. Mm-hmm. So it's classic that way. A lot of my work is about just the human behaviors. Set aside the beliefs that they claim they are crusading for. That's window dressing. Yes. That's branding. If you look at the behavior, the sense of sudden school, as the Buddhists would talk about, where suddenly you wake up and now you're enlightened, I don't trust that stuff at all.
Yeah.
But back then on the commune, I was feeling like, yeah, that's what we have to do. Everybody's an educatable unit. You just feed them the truth about the world, about kindness, about generosity, that love is the answer, whatever, and they'll get it.
Yeah.
So then I end up with this kid. Mm-hmm. And I realize, no, you can't even begin to do moral philosophy until you wake up to the fact that, until you acknowledge that some percentage of us just aren't born to get that message. Mm-hmm. Some of us are born psychopathic. Some of us become psychopathic. Some of us have psychopathy thrust upon us. Mm-hmm. I haven't said that before, but that's kind of true. And if you don't factor that in and you just think everybody on the count of three, let's be nice, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
It's not going to work because the nicer you get, the more susceptible you are to being preyed upon by the people who are not nice.
Yeah.
You know, if we could all lose our weapons on the count of three and there'd be no more weapons, I'd be for it. But that doesn't mean that we can transition there by me just surrendering all of my weapons because there are these other people who have weapons. So that's one of the paradoxes or conundrums that I woke up to. You could say through my son.
Yeah, I figured that. Well,
he has been the greatest muse in my life. Yeah. We don't talk anymore. I would talk to him if he ever stopped threatening me. But if he was willing to talk adult to adult, I'm right here. But that's not what he does with me anymore. But he has been crucial to making me who I am. I would not have gotten interested in the questions I did if I continued to think, you could say, the woke theory that all you just got to do is tell people that love is the answer. Yeah. You know, I play in bands. I'm in reggae bands and that kind of band. And a lot of their songs are still under the assumption that, you know, just tell people that love is the answer and then everybody will be nice. And then, no, I'll play those songs, but no, I don't think so.
The reason why I asked that question is because here you are with the knowledge of and the study of human behavior. And so I wanted to know, I wanted to arrest you right here to see with the knowledge and all of that stuff and have someone close to you. How did you manage that and come to grips with the fact that human behavior, as you study in human decision making, and here you have a son that you're talking to me about, and I'm saying, to
"Oh no,
that must be some fun."
That's true. Though I know some really famous psychologists, the top of their game, who married someone who turned out to not be mentally stable. Mm-hmm. That's a different situation. Yeah. You may choose your partner. You don't choose your kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You make them, but you don't design them.
Yes.
They come with their own temperaments.
Yep.
I came from a culture that simply assumed that if a kid was acting weird, that's because of bad parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's half true, just not completely true. That is, you can end up with kids that are just, I tried everything with this one except consistency. Mm-hmm. That is, I had to try different things out because nothing was working. Mm-hmm. And I wish him well, but I wouldn't have invited this style of person into my life. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a different situation, but this is also a difference between me and a bunch of other people who work in academics.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly an academic. I'm what you'd call a gent scholar. Yeah. That is, with the money, I get to, I don't have to worry about making a living from it. So I'm not a tenured professor. Mm-hmm. I got my PhD real late, so I couldn't have probably become a tenured professor. You have to start young and you have to do, you have to pay your dues for years as the kind of, you know, the go-to for all the menial tasks in academics before you get to become a tenured professor. No, I bring my heart to work with me. Yeah. I'm a lab for my research. And a lot of researchers don't trust that. Yeah. They want to act like, let's all just check our egos and biases at the door. Mm-hmm. And then we become credible. So we write in a really dry style. Mm-hmm. I don't do much of that writing. I write some academic articles. I've written one book for Columbia University Press. But I'm saying, no, you can't leave your ego at the door. You're going to have to manage it throughout research. It's not like you can just become neutral in this stuff. Mm-hmm. And this relates to something you said before we started the interview. I even coined a term for it yesterday. I'm centrist cerebral. I'm a centrist cerebral gent, by which I mean my heart is very alive. Mm-hmm. And it's connected to my head, which causes all sorts of complications, which I'm happy to live with. The Buddhists describe it this way. There's a line I like. I'm not Buddhist, but I like a line or two here. Though my heart is on fire, my eyes are cold as ashes.
Yep.
and I like that kind of contrast, that I'm trying to be neutral in the analysis of my non-neutrality, of the fact that I'm a human with lots of skin in the game, trying to understand, trying to cope with the world.
Yeah.
So the centa cerebral is about that. Mm-hmm. That is you're really trying to get a realistic sense of the world, and you know in your heart that your heart's not realistic.
Yeah.
I got all sorts of drives. I'm human.
Right? I think it's necessary to have the combination of both. It gives us a different picture and so forth. Now, I want you to talk to this, Jeremy, because you have done some studies and I'm sure you've noticed certain patterns and stuff like that with the human experience that makes decisions. Some patterns, but there's not all, you know, within the madness, there's some patterns that are there, but then the madness. So talk to the audience about the decision process in the human experience from your understanding.
From the research. Our research, I'm working, there's a picture behind me, the guy at the top who's looking off in that direction. That's
my right.
That's been my research colleague for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. I became a student of him. He was on my PhD committee, and then we ended up just jamming for 25 years. Yeah. He's an interesting cat.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Harvard neuroscientist when I met him. Mm-hmm. They called him a genius and a saint at Harvard. The saint part was about that he would talk to anybody who's interested in the same questions. He never pulls rank.
Yeah.
He's not that kind of academic. He's a neuroscientist and a biological anthropologist who spent his first 20 years of research working on a fundamental difference between humans and other organisms, language.
Yeah.
Language is a different kind of sign system than what other animals have. We have this kind of infinite vocabulary of words we can mix and match to make all sorts of concepts seem possible to us. So he was trying to understand the evolution of language, how that happened. And when I first read his book before I met him, I cried, not because it was moving. It's not a moving book.
Yeah.
They also said that he writes like a truck at Harvard because it's rather dense and scientific.
Yeah.
I cried because I didn't understand it. It was over my it made me feel dumb. But then we ended up meeting, and then we ended up with lots of conversations about that. And as I was doing my PhD with him, he woke me up, you could say, or he teased out of me a question I had never thought of before that almost never, nobody ever thinks about. Yeah. We are self-obsessed trying to figure out what to try to do. Mm-hmm. That's what people are.
Yeah.
But what ourselves and what is trying has never been explained.
That's true.
When people say Darwin explained it, no, Darwin didn't explain it. He assumed selves trying. He assumed selves struggling for their own existence. He knew he didn't explain the struggle for existence, which is trying.
Yeah.
And so this guy had gotten into this question, basically, what is trying and how did it start? Because you could say that something was added to chemistry, you know, that life was breathed into chemistry to make it start being beings and trying. No, you don't get to say that in science. You don't get to say, if you have a supernatural explanation for anything in science, you have a supernatural explanation for everything. Yeah. You know, why am I sitting here? Because some supernatural force made me want to sit here and talk to you. No, that won't work in science. I think of science as a campaign to find natural explanations for all natural phenomena. Yeah. And trying is a natural phenomenon, so there's got to be a natural explanation. He had just gotten into that question at that time. What is trying, and how did it start? Mm-hmm. What are selves and trying? Yeah. And we've been jamming on that for 25 years, mm-hmm. and he's written a book about it, and I've written a book about it, and we have a whole theory of how it started, and it's one of the contenders. You could say it's origins of life research. No smoke and mirrors. You've got to explain it from simple chemistry. Yeah. How did chemistry ever become a system that is doing work that works to keep it working within its work situation, mm-hmm. is how I think about it.
Yeah.
This is selves doing functional interpretive behavior. Because check this out, in physics, you don't get to say the moon was trying to pull on the tides. they drum you out.
Yeah.
And yet in the life and social sciences, you can't help but say that there's trying going on. There are people who try to say that there's no trying.
Mm-hmm.
They say, you can try to believe there's trying, but there isn't, which is just absurd. They can say, convince yourself you're not a self, but that doesn't work. That doesn't work. That kind of pretzel logic doesn't work for me. So I want to make sure to get to your question. This is a lot of background.
No.
Here's one way to think about it. Here's a simple way to think about it. We're talking about how beliefs change habits, but also habits change beliefs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's not a great name for that kind of process, but it's called a strange loop.
Yeah.
It's basically checks and balances, two things constraining each other. You could call it mutual constraints. Mm-hmm. Your beliefs, of all the things you could believe, you have a constrained belief. Of all the things you could do, you have your constrained habits. The two systems are actually mutually shaping. Mm-hmm. They shape each other.
Yeah.
You can think about it like a couple, or you can think about it like a board game. Those are all strange loops.
Yeah.
And not only that, we're in the business of trying to keep the strange loop going.
Yeah.
When you're playing a game, you want to end the strange loop, the mutual constraint. You want to beat the other side. Mm-hmm. But in running a government or in being alive, either of those systems, you're trying to keep the strange loop going.
Mm-hmm.
You need your checks and balances. Okay, well, the first level of checks and balances that we have going on is the same one that we have in common with all organisms.
Mm-hmm.
Today, regardless of whether I get much work done, I am going to generate 240 billion replacement cells.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do that without thinking about it, without feeling it. That's my silent sense self running on its own. It's all the stuff that I am doing that works, the work I do that works to keep me working within my work setting.
Yes.
So I have to take in food. I got to eat and all this sort of stuff. So I got that going on. And so does a tree, and so does a bacterium.
Yeah.
That's what all life has in common. Yeah. This hustle to outpace degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's falling apart. It's called the second law of thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. Everything's falling apart. You look at a body, once it dies, that thing falls apart. I'm busy trying to not fall apart. That's job one for dude. Okay. Then on top of that, you've got the emotional level of, which is, so there's a strange loop, the relationship between my what we call vegetative sentience.
Mm-hmm.
That's this hustle that I'm doing all the time just to stay alive.
Yeah.
Then there's the feeling level, and then there's the conceptual level, and they're all tangled up now.
Mm-hmm.
So I can have a thought that makes my body panic. Okay. I can have a worry that makes my emotional body panic, which actually starts to do debilitating work so that one day I only produce 200 billion new cells because I'm thinking dangerous thoughts. You know, or whatever. You know, the relationship between them is a cluster flux.
Yeah, yeah.
It's complicated how they all work.
Yeah.
We'd like to pretend it's easy. I call it robo-envy. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that humans are these programmable units.
Yeah.
That was the kind of naivete I had back when I thought, just tell people love is the answer and everybody will be reprogrammed to think that. No, we're not like that. It's way more complicated than that. So it's, for me, a lot of it is about paying attention to the dilemmas, the fundamental dilemmas that we're all dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
the challenges that we deal with, and we deal with them through our sentience, through our emotions, through our thoughts. It's complicated, but there are some general dilemmas that everybody's dealing with. Yeah. Everybody has different parenting, but by a certain age, I think everybody has encountered these fundamental dilemmas. Should I participate in this? Should I say this? Should I delay gratification? You know, all these kind of fundamental things, they show up everywhere over and over. We're all dealing with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, because I wanted the reason why I asked that question is because I wanted to bring in the ability of our process of choosing, what I wanted to point at, the process of choosing, because that, I believe, when you were talking about your life and you were, as you were saying, your brothers, they chose, and you were still trying to find something
to decide,
to choose. Right. So,
good.
That good piece right there, I want you to talk about that piece right there. That's choosing.
I'm really glad you brought that up. Thank you for grounding this conversation, because I'm guessing where we're going. Okay, so one of the books I've liked on decision making is the subtitle was How Decisions Happen. Mm-hmm. He's trying to take that subtitle reflects a way in which, while we'd like to pretend that we are our conscious minds selecting among options on an even playing field. And we are that vision of our rationality is an okay first approximation of what's going on, but I don't think it's quite like that. Mm-hmm. You can think about it as a kind of convergence. There are these something will happen that will tip you into a new relationship, a new directionality. Like, yeah. I used to give this example when I was teaching psychology. I got married and had three kids because I lost my toothbrush. Mm-hmm. One night. It wasn't like the losing of the toothbrush suddenly turned me on that path. You could think of it as like it tipped me onto the edge of a funnel, mm-hmm. because I ended up borrowing my future wife's toothbrush, mm-hmm. that night. And yeah. it was one of the ways we started to get a little more connected to each other. Yeah. Let's think of yourself as dropping down some directionality, and you tip onto a funnel, and little by little, you are drawn more and more into a system of behavior. Yeah. There is a tipping point. There is a point at which you ended up on the edge of some kind of, and you can think of it like a gravy train. Mm-hmm. You do something, it gets some benefit. You do it some more, it gets some benefit. It becomes more and more reliably what you end up doing. Mm-hmm. You can want something like that, or you can worry about something like that. That is, that same tipping point can work for getting addicted to heroin, yes. as it can for getting addicted to the work that you are totally dedicated to doing.
Yeah.
And often what'll happen is, this is my colleague, the guy behind me there, is writing a book right now called Falling Up, and he's trying to Falling Up. Mm-hmm. And what he's trying to explain is how parts ever come together to become wholes. Mm-hmm. And really to explain how, because all this work is not about describing, it's about explaining how it really happens.
Yeah.
And we think it actually happens through a process of very much like addiction. Mm-hmm. That is, when you find yourself connected to something, a line of work or a person, let's take a person because it might be easier to see this yeah. way, you actually begin to lose a capacity to do things for yourself because the outside source can do it for you.
Yeah.
This is how I'm, this may seem far afield, but I'm going to jump
to it. No, it's not, because I believe where you're heading, because everything is an addiction.
Yeah, addiction. Yeah, no, I want good addictions, not yes. bad ones. I love my addictions. I'm very grateful for my gravy trains. No, that's exactly the point.
Yeah.
So check this out.
Yeah.
All mammals except us and guinea pigs, mm-hmm. produce their own vitamin C. Vitamin C is an antioxidant. Yeah. It's basically how you keep your body from rusting, mm-hmm. Degenerating. Oxygen is very energetic. And so living in an oxygen-rich environment is going to erode things. all mammals produce their own except us, except a bunch of primates and a few other mammals. What happened? Why is it that I need vitamin C from an outside source, but you don't have to give your cat vitamin C? It makes its own vitamin C.
Yeah.
35 million years ago, our primate ancestors move out of a nocturnal lifestyle where they're out only at night and they move up into trees. They can be out during daylight now because they're safer and the trees have fruit in them. Our old ancestors, they could make their own vitamin C like cats. Okay. But suddenly they have this reliable source of vitamin C that's already in a kind of co-addictive relationship, a codependent relationship with birds, because birds would eat the fruit and then disseminate the seeds. So we're there too, and we start mooching off the off the fruit. And when it comes to genetics, it's use it or lose it. If there's no pressure to keep that gene, you'll lose that gene. So now we know what genes we had that made it possible for us to make vitamin C, but they're broken. They're junk DNA now. They don't work anymore. Why? Because we found this reliable source of external vitamin C. And not only that, color vision, our capacity to see beyond black and white, was evolved to distinguish red from ripe from unripe fruit. Suddenly, because we no longer needed our retinas to be covered with rods to see in the dark. We were monochromatic in the dark when we were on the ground, but now we no longer need that, so we lose that capacity. All of those rods start morphing, and they end up turning into, many of them turn into cones of three colors, the ability to distinguish red from green. So you get these addictions, and then the loss of traits because you don't need them. Here's a parallel from the cultural realm. My ancestors used to farm. Suddenly there were two ways to get food. You could get it from a farm or you get it from a store. We lost our ability to farm. We could get it back, but we lost it because we are now addicted to grocery stores. So how choices get made. Yeah, there's the simple version where I'm sitting there and choosing, and you get that when you go shopping, for example, when you shop there. But how we shop among interpretations of our reality, how we end up with these habits of behavior and habits of belief, that's a more complicated story. We don't sit down and say, okay, which religion am I going to choose? You end up with a bunch of habits and, you know, maybe you fall in love with someone who's part of a church and suddenly you're a member of that church.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, how many people are like that? You know, it's just a countless amount of people.
That's how we are.
It's just a happenstance.
The drummer I play with in the reggae band I play with, he was a wild guy when he was young. He was a porn star. He did some wild stuff. So between when I met him and we started playing together, and now he married a born again Christian, and now he won't do any reggae songs that include the words Haile Selassie because it offends the Jesus. So you know, if you want a prediction of how someone's going to behave in a few years, you can say addictions are good for predictions. You can figure out if someone's addicted to this kind of relationship. If you're on this gravy train, chances are good the behavior is going to be shaped by it over time.
Yeah, that is awesome. What instruments you play, Jeremy? What instruments you play?
I'm a bass player and singer.
Are you really?
Yes, I'm a jazz, funk, soul, reggae, world bass player. I have the good fortune to play with some Nigerians who came to the States and are just, I mean, one of them toured with Stevie Wonder. I'm not that good, but I just adore it. That's an interesting addiction too. Someone showed up I was living at a free school where you didn't even have to attend classes. Someone shows up with the bass guitar. I got hooked on it at 14 and it's been an addiction throughout my life. When my marriage ended and I needed someplace to put my love because she didn't want it anymore, I ended up putting it into the bass. I got really serious about it. Yeah. And now I'm no longer partnered. I say I'm glad that my lack of appetite finally caught up with my lack of aptitude. I'm not that good at close range. Nobody should be forced to be around me that much. But I think that sex is music for non-musicians. See, in a way, I got addicted to music for the sensual qualities of it. And at this point, I'm too much trouble to be in partnership. And besides, I'm getting my sensual jollies through music.
Yeah.
I get to gig out a few times a week. I practice every night. I just love it.
The reason why I ask, I'm a bass player as well.
You are a bass player. There you go. What kind of music do you play?
Oh, we play reggae. We play jazz. I play it all. I started in rock and roll,
So we have a very parallel life.
Yeah. I had a white bass guitar. They used to call me Jimmy. I had my hair long and rocking it out. And then I transitioned into jazz. I heard a tape from one day when I was hanging out with some friends. Heard a tape with Miles and the bass. And I was like, wait a minute. And so I started practicing on him. And then I got into smooth jazz and lost my mind when. And so I got a chance to meet quite a few people as well. Through the music and stuff like that.
So are you getting to play in Thailand?
No, I haven't played since I started traveling, but I couldn't bring my bass with me, you know, traveling because of thing. But music is something else as far as I used to tell people that when I played my bass, Jeremy, I would close my eyes and the bass, I was like hugging the bass and just playing, and I told people, I said, you are actually participating in voyeurism because you're getting to see me. I just enjoy the music and everything on the bass. And so I'm resting my head on the instrument.
No, that's right.
And just having this experience that I can only explain as a voyeurism that the audience is having a chance to.
That's experience. Right. There, it's interesting. There are some art forms that are truly real-time self-pleasuring. Mm-hmm. And I would say music and dance would be the most prominent ones of that. And I definitely feel that way. That's what I'm describing. We're on the same wave there. Yeah. We're probably even, our musical interests are the same. Yeah. I started out with rock, but rock doesn't
fill
interest
me
much
yeah.
now. Mm-hmm. No, I actually, I need funk and I need booty in my music. And if I'm not getting that, I can play it, but it's just not as much fun. Yeah. And it's definitely a sensual act. This is why I gig a lot, but the audience doesn't actually matter that much to me. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it for me. I'm having a good time.
I totally can relate because I just love it so much that it's a part of me. And it's when you're not there having my bass, I would, I used to make them as well. I would take them and I used to buy bass that were broken down and build my fretless bass and build it to my specs. So I knew when I touched that thing, I can close my eyes and not even worry about nothing. I knew exactly where I was.
No, that's right. I'm definitely a bass fetishist too.
Yeah.
That is, it's been so. This does relate to something else, which is that's important to me about humans and about language makes us a radically different creature from other organisms. Yeah. I think we underappreciate how inherently anxious humans would be in comparison to other animals. Mm-hmm. Other animals are exposed to the elements and all of that. But if you compare what an animal can worry about to what a human can worry about, all the real and imaginary threats and missed opportunities that could keep you up at night, it's just no contest.
Yeah.
And that's language. Language makes us radically anxious as an organism. And language gives us a way to escape the anxieties, to avoid thinking about them. You can rationalize your way out of thinking about things. We can do that in a way that other organisms can't. They're stuck in real time.
Yeah.
We're able to imagine a heavenly hereafter or hell or just all sorts of things. And we will end up with confirmation bias. That is, we will tend to take in the ideas that feel affirming to us and keep out the ideas that don't feel affirming to us. Mm-hmm. That will be part of human nature. What do we do about that?
Yeah.
From my perspective, we have underappreciated the role of entertainment and escapism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a human necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody could afford to be realistic all the time. Yeah. It's just too much.
Yeah.
It's too much world, and we need escapism. So I have paid a lot of attention to what I'd call optimal illusion,
mm-hmm.
safe escapism, how to kid yourself in ways that help, not harm.
Yeah.
We all need it, and we all do it, and there are safe ways to do it, and there are non-safe ways to do it. I say self-love. So I'm talking about, you know, a lot of my work, I didn't mention much of it, but a lot of it is about people indulging in playing God.
Yeah,
that is a lot of my work I call psychoproctology. I'm trying to diagnose, treat, and prevent jerk behavior,
yeah.
a-hole behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, I think escapism is essential. So we need to play God. We need that kind of self-love,
mm-hmm.
that exaggerated self-love, but we need to get a room. We can't be doing it in politics. That's not where it belongs.
Yeah.
It belongs in music. It belongs in entertainment. Safe escapism includes watching a movie in which you identify with the hero as if you're Iron Man. And then when the movie's over, turning it off and returning to reality knowing you're not.
Yeah.
So how you balance between those two is interesting. And for me, playing music has been part of that kind of safe escapism.
Yeah.
As I can feel like a guitar hero when I'm playing, mm-hmm. I know I'm not.
Yeah.
I know I'm an okay player. But that is part of it. And it's also part of what I'm talking about is self-pleasuring.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually saying that masturbation is actually safer and saner.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretending you're a sexual god is safer and saner than going to an ideological rally, a cult rally, and playing God there, and then not zipping up when you're done, not returning to reality, but pretending you've just experienced something more real than real reality. That's dangerous.
That's dangerous.
But if you take your flights of fancy, but always with a return ticket to reality secure in your heart pocket,
mm-hmm.
that's safe escapism. That's optimal illusion. And we need it.
Yeah.
Humans need it.
Jeremy, man, thank you so much for coming by Threads of Enlightenment.
We've
been talking for an hour, man, and change.
I'm sorry if I went
no,
too long.
No, I love this because it is a necessary conversation, and it gave people a different slant on how to look things. That's why I was asking you those questions. Because
yeah,
I wanted to pull those things out of you.
He
is an author. Jeremy's an author, and he wrote some books. One of them is What's Up with Assholes. And I want you guys to go and buy his books. Grab as many as you can, because I keep telling people, Jeremy, that when you sit down with an author's book, you're having a private session with him or her. And that is in your quiet time, in your secure area where you get a cup of tea, coffee, or a brewski, as they say, and you're having a private conversation with Jeremy. Grab his books and have that private conversation, because in it is lots of powerful insights to help you to become the better human spirit. Jeremy, thank you so much, man.
Thank you for having me on. Great to talk with you, Ken.